This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Only freed member of the Angola 3 will join me. He'll bring us up to date on the case and ask you to join Amnesty International in demanding an immediate, compassionate release for Herman Wallace. That's Save Herman Wallace on a Deeper Look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO Community Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd Avenue, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. This program was also made possible in part by the Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world, and I'm Stephanie Potter. This month, we're going to focus on actions taking place here in the Pacific Northwest to confront climate change. They're part of the nationwide 350.org Summer Heat Mobilization Against the Fossil Fuel Industry. David Osborne is here to discuss fossil fuel exports in the Pacific Northwest and the Columbia River climate action being sponsored by Summer Heat Northwest and Rising Tide. That takes place this Saturday, July 27th, as part of the nationwide movement. And we've also got Bonnie McKinley, who's going to be talking about the No KXL Pledge of Resistance. This is where Northwest activists have joined a national effort to halt construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, which would be transporting Alberta's tar sands oil to the Gulf Coast. Bonnie works on climate issues with Power, Past Coal, Rising Tide, Greenpeace, 350.pdx, and the Sierra Club. Oh, and by the way, David is a Portland State University instructor, and he's a participant in the climate justice movement and the Portland Rising Tide, and was deeply involved in Occupy Portland. That's right, David. And then we've got Tori Cole. She's here to cover the push to get Oregon to divest from fossil fuels. And she is also a climate justice activist and an organizer with 350 PDX campaign to do divestment. And you're entering your second year at in law school, right?
At Lewis and Clark, right.
Great. Okay. So I just want to welcome all of you here. And we can also take calls from listeners if you want to call us at 503-231-8187. So, David, I wanted to start with you. And there's a couple of things, especially there's a couple of things happening right away. There's that action this Saturday, July 27th. And it's the Columbia River Action Plan, right?
Yeah, it's the Columbia River Climate Action, and it's going to be this Saturday, July 27th. And it's part of a series of nationally coordinated actions by 350, who we're working with, us as Portland Rising Tide are working with. There are all sorts of stuff happening all over the country. I was just in Utah, where folks were mobilizing to try and stop the tar sands mining in Utah that is proposed for the state. And there were folks up in the Northeast working on actions around natural gas pipelines and all sorts of stuff to address the climate crisis throughout the country. And so here in the Northwest, what's going on here is that there are some 15-plus fossil fuel export terminals proposed in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. And many of those are really close to where we are here in the Portland metropolitan area. So what we're going to be doing on Saturday is going out. We're going to have folks showing up in the morning. There's going to be workshops at 10:30, speakers from around the region at 12:30. And then most importantly, we're going to be taking action at 1:30 and creating an image of what it will look like if these fossil fuel corporations try and move coal as they want to on barge for the Morro Pacific project, if they want to move oil as they do with the Vancouver Oil Terminal that was just approved yesterday morning by the Port of Vancouver commissioners.
That was approved.
It was approved by the Port of Vancouver commissioners. Yeah, that terminal would move about 380,000 barrels per day. And it still has some process to go. The governor of Washington, Governor Inslee, has to approve it as well. But I think it's really important to understand that even if he approves it, that doesn't necessarily mean it moves forward, because we in our communities have the power to stop these projects and really have, I think, a moral obligation to, because of the devastating impact that they would have, not only globally through climate change, but also on the different communities along the rail lines, as well as those communities in the zones of extraction and fracking, such as in North Dakota or up in the tar sands and other places.
Could you talk a little bit about, like, there's 15 of these terminals and there's a couple right here in the Portland area. And what would this actually look like, having these, you know, you're going to show what it looks like?
So, yeah, to paint a picture, I mean, what would the Vancouver Oil Terminal, there'd be multiple large storage tanks holding 380,000 barrels a day. There'd be large vessels coming in, multiple vessels a day to, or not multiple vessels a day, but there'd be many vessels coming in to the port to pick up that oil. There would be huge 100-unit trains traveling four round trips a day into the Port of Vancouver to bring these trains. These are the same types of trains that crashed tragically in Quebec recently, killing 50 people.
And forcing 1,000 to evacuate from their homes.
Yes, totally. I mean, almost totally destroying the small town in which that happened. So that's what the oil terminal would look like. I mean, the coal terminal would be taking coal by train to Boardman, having it loaded on barge, and then moved to Port Westward, which is near Klaskanai, or to be transloaded onto large Panamax vessels, and then it would sail out to sea. The liquefied natural gas terminal in Astoria would be huge LNG tankers coming in under the guard of the Coast Guard, because they're deemed to be a national security threat. So there's like an exclusion zone around the entire vessel when it comes into port, which would have huge impact on the fishing communities there, the ability to cross the bar, get out of harbor in weather windows, and so forth. There would be a pipeline cut through the National Forest in Washington, crossing the Columbia River, and then across into Warrenton, that would go across people's land, through their front yards, across the ranches, their farms. And so that's kind of, you know, what it looks like on the transportation and export side. And then I think it's really important to think about, especially as we have the opportunity to really work against these terminals. We have the opportunity to not only stop those impacts locally, and to not only stop those impacts globally that climate change will cause, but also to address those impacts where extraction happens and where communities are being devastated by fracking, oil drilling, tar sands extraction, strip mining of coal, and really, you know, really being impacted in a pretty intense way. And if we can take action here, then these corporations can't ship these fuels. And if they can't ship the fuels, then they can't sell them. And what that will mean is that those fuels will stay in the ground, which is where they need to be if we're serious about addressing the climate crisis.
So we become the bottleneck if we can really get strong about doing this.
We're one of the bottlenecks. There's this huge, I mean, with 15 plus terminals, there is this clear push by the fossil fuel industry to move fossil fuels out of the Northwest.
And so, all of it goes not into, you know, like we're always talking about sustainability of our own energy, but this doesn't, nothing for the U.S. It goes to China. It goes across the world.
The coal and the gas terminals are for export. The oil terminals, they claim, are to just move the oil to the refineries up in Washington, mm-hmm. Because it's illegal to export U.S. crude. So this original proposal, allegedly the crude is coming from the Bakken Shale. However, I think if you look at a map, and anyone that's been on a boat off the coast, you know that it takes a long time to go by boat from Vancouver up to Bellingham. But by train, it's only a few hours. And so we really believe that this is infrastructure that's also built for tar sands, because as Canadian oil, it can be exported abroad. And also with some of the recent victories, the at least temporary defeat of the Northern Gateway Pipeline in British Columbia, which would have moved tar sands oil west to the coast of Vancouver or to the coast of British Columbia for export. With the defeat of pipelines like that, there's increasing pressure on those corporations involved in the tar sands extraction extraction, which is one of the most destructive projects on the face of the planet, to move that oil by any means necessary, including by train.
Yeah, and all through all of us. And let's get back to the idea of keeping it in the ground. Let's talk about why that is so important. I mean, I've seen the Bill McKibben talk, Do the Math. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, we're already, in terms of the kind of climate impacts that we're having, we're already at a pretty significant state of warming. We're already at 400 parts per million that just happened this year. And it's really critical to mitigate or address in whatever way that we can those kinds of climate impacts, which I will mention will be most disproportionately felt by those that have least contributed to it in the global south, as well as those communities here, poor, low-income communities that have also had the least role in contributing to some of these things. This crisis will impact people in different ways, and it's really important to keep that in mind. And so if we're serious about addressing the climate crisis, we have to stop all new extraction. We have to start to come down from the level of burning of fossil fuels, which are one of the primary contributors to greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide in particular, but also others. And we need to immediately start from a place of trying to reduce our level of fossil fuel use. And that's going to start by ceasing all new extraction. So the last kind of fracking well that was put in this morning, the last drag line that was brought into operation in a coal mine, the last pipeline that was put into the ground today, these need to be the last ones ever, because we have to immediately stop this new extraction, start where we have the kind of mass amounts of fossil fuels that we're already extracting, and begin to move down from that towards a just transition to a sustainable economy.
It's almost like you're talking about we've got to shut down the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. I mean, this is an industry, and especially if we keep in mind the economic context in which we operate, in which profit is valued above all else, this industry makes their money from fossil fuels. So they are not going to stop unless we stop them, because they have such an incentive to continue these practices despite how destructive they are. And so that is, I think, really important. And it's why we're coming out on Saturday to Vancouver Landing, which is just west of the I-5 bridge in Washington. And again, we're going to have speakers from around the region at 12:30. We're going to take action at 1:30. We're just going to be forming a symbolic blockade. There's no coal barges. There's no oil trains going to the Port of Vancouver. These things aren't happening yet. So we're not going to be blocking any ships or doing anything like that. But we want to show, we want to create an image of how we will respond if these things happen, because we believe that nonviolent direct action is appropriate and is very effective when you look at historic social movements in creating social change. Our communities have power to create a just and sustainable world. And so we want to create an image of the kind of united opposition to the coal, oil, and gas fossil fuel terminals proposed throughout our region, and to kind of show that we are ready and committed to doing what we need to do in this region to make sure that we have a livable and just world for ourselves and future generations.
And it's going to be fun, actually. And you don't have to have a boat or a kayak. I mean, people can do things on the land and people can do things in kayaks, but there's a lot of different ways to participate, and families are invited to this
thing.
Yeah,
totally. It's going to be super fun.
It's almost like a picnic.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be really fun. It's very family friendly. I mean, we're going to have kind of speakers, and there'll be some music later on at Vancouver Landing. If people want to go out in the water, we have some kayaks and other boats that people can get into. And if people don't, we have a kind of march that'll be going up on the pedestrian way, just on the sidewalk of the I-5 bridge, so that we have a huge kind of line of people up on the bridge above the kayaks once they kind of get out into the river. And we'll also have things at Vancouver Landing if people just kind of want to hang out there and kind of watch the whole thing unfold. It's going to be a really beautiful day, and we really hope that folks will come out and join us.
And to find out about it, people need to get in touch with Summer Heat Northwest or Rising Tide?
Yeah, I mean, all this information is available at portlandrisingtide.org. So you can find all the details about it there. You can also go to the National Summer Heat website, which is joinsummerheat.org. And you can also find, when you click on the Portland Action, the Northwest Action, all the details to figure out how to get there and what the time frames are, if you forgot kind of what I mentioned earlier. So we really hope that folks will come out and join us.
It sounds like something that we all need to go to. And we've got more going on here, though. I just want to let people know you're tuned to the Recovery Zone, KBOO Portland 90.7. And my three guests are here to talk about climate actions here in the Northwest. I have David Osborne, who just talked about the fossil fuel terminals and an action taking place, the Columbia River Climate Action thing. And we've also got Tori Cole, right? That's your name?
Yep.
And Bonnie McKinley is also here to talk, and she'll be talking about the Pledge of Resistance to the KXL pipeline. But Tori, you're here to talk about divestment, basically, right? And
right.
What's happening in Oregon in terms of divestment? And basically, the whole idea of divestment, what is it exactly?
That is a question that we get a lot. So I'm going to try and make it as simple as possible. So divestment essentially is a conscious moral decision by people or an institution to shift their investments in fossil fuels into socially responsible investments. Essentially to say, we refuse to make money from the destruction of our climate, and to align stated values with real concrete actions. So that's what, you know, 350 has really grown from, and it's becoming a national sort of movement, and we are really trying to take a stand here in the Northwest region to stand strong and be a big part of that movement.
And the government institutions are where you're starting with this, right?
So we're trying to take a sort of like multi-pronged effort. We are a fledgling organization, 350 PDX, which is like the local chapter of the national 350. And so the idea is to try from all angles. So I'm going to be associated with the campus effort. We're going to have efforts to talk about divestment and have people interested in that on PSU's campus, at Lewis and Clark's campus, and also at Reed, if we can. But also on the level of the city, we had a couple organizers with 350 PDX testify at City Hall on World Environment Day, which was last month. And we were thrilled when directly thereafter, Portland City Mayor Charlie Hales made a reference to divesting Portland in his speech afterwards. So we've had some contact with the mayor's office as well as some other officials with the city, and it looks like Portland is, you know, going to live up to its reputation as a progressive city and work on divestment. But statewide for Oregon, it's going to be a little bit of a slower process. At this point, state investments are legally required to take into account only return rates. So that is, they're only allowed to look at profit, mm-hmm. essentially, when they make investments.
And not the big picture.
Exactly. They're not allowed to consider how socially responsible one or another investment might be. So we are going to have to work to change that if we want to see that happen and be a reality for Oregon. So we do have a government divestment team, and that's their primary focus right now, but it's going to take a lot of concerted action to make that happen. Also, we are having a regional meetup the day after the action that David was talking about, which is really aimed at getting people who are interested in this kind of thing engaged in the network of people who are working on divestment. So that's going to be on Sunday, July 28th at First Congregational United Church of Christ, which is at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue. So again, that's really, it's co-hosted with Grow Divestment, which is a group of 350 affiliated student leaders. It's not just for students. We're really trying to focus on having leaders in all communities come together, because it's a lot easier of a task if we can have concerted efforts.
Well, has divestment actually ever really worked before? Oh, by the way, I just want to let listeners know again, give us a call, 503-231-8187, if you want to ask a question or make a comment. But anyway, back to this. Is divestment something that's actually that effective?
If you've ever heard Bill McKibben talk, he talks a lot about this, but he says that really where this comes from, we're modeling it off of the South Africa divestment movement, which in the 1980s, you know, there was apartheid in South Africa, and some students at educational institutions throughout the United States decided to sort of engage with that and say, we don't want our colleges to have endowments that are invested in companies that support this apartheid that work in South Africa. And so by 1988, 155 educational institutions had divested completely from all organizations or from all corporations with ties to that.
To South Africa.
Right. And also, I mean, these are smaller efforts, but since then, there have been concerted efforts by activists to get social institutions to divest from big tobacco. More recently, to divest from companies with ties to Darfur. And so those have been more localized actions, but they have been successful with a smaller number. And this, in the 1980s, the South African divestment, our President Barack Obama was one of the activists who was working to get that divestment achieved. So today, 350 is growing almost, you know, more than it can deal with. But there are more than 300 campuses in the nation that are striving to get their colleges to divest. And I think last time I checked, it's 11 cities that have made some sort of commitment to divest as well. So
And Eugene, Oregon is actually one, right?
Yes, it is. We have one right here in Oregon.
Right. And Portland has made a commitment or is about to? Or
The mayor has said that he is going to, you know, make it happen. But we would like to see a resolution passed by the city council itself. So that's something that we're working on. We're still getting petitions signed, even though we have well over 1,000 signatures to make sure that that really gets done, isn't just, you know,
yeah, just a pipe dream.
Them saying something.
Sounds like we have a caller. Marie, what would you like to ask us?
Yes, my question is, I live in Hood River, and my question is, can our city council also work on divestment, and can all the small cities around Oregon, everyone else, join in with that through their city council process?
To some extent, that depends on the structure of your city. We had to do some research on the way to address our city council in terms of testifying, expressing interest. But I would say the first thing you should do is, you know, what we did, which is the petition structure, which to really show like how many of your citizens are interested in this, are engaged. I'd also like to mention that 350 PDX is looking forward to becoming 350 Oregon and really providing some support for smaller cities around Portland. And if you have questions about that, definitely feel free to go to 350pdx.org and send us an email. We'd be glad to support. We have been working a little bit with 350 Corvallis that has a small but active membership and is trying to do the same thing. So for sure, I think the best steps to take are petitioning and doing a little bit of research about what you need to do to address your city council.
That's great.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It sounds like it's a lot of energy for this. It's good. And talk about how it actually helps with climate change. I mean, what will this divestment really do?
Absolutely. So a lot of people have said this is sort of like an abstract thing, but I really don't think it is. I think there are two ways distinctly that it can make an impact. First of all, our main goal is to keep as many fossil fuels in the ground as possible.
Back to that. Keep it in the ground.
Bill always says in his talks, you know, we have currently the fossil fuel industries in reserve outside of the earth have 5 times more fossil fuels than we can safely burn.
5 times more.
Correct.
Like even if we burned 1/5 of what they have in the ground, it's not safe for us.
Well, this is not even what's in the ground. This is what they've already dug up.
Oh, in the reserves. Yeah. Oh, that they've already dug up. Oh, my goodness.
So we really can't afford to take any more out of the ground. And yet the fossil fuel industry continues to be an incredibly powerful force in our society, and they plan to burn enough carbon to send us into a climate catastrophe.
Like we'll be like the planet Mercury or something.
Hopefully not that intense, but it will be much, our climate reality will be different. It already will be, but we need to stop it from getting worse. So, like I said, the fossil fuel industry, they plan to send us to the grave, and yet their lobbyists still write our laws. The industry continues to drill on our lands and pollute our air and waterways unchecked. Like David said, their only goal is profit, and they're not going to stop unless we stop them. So the goal of divestment really is to take away the social license of these companies. We urgently need to take away their credibility as somebody who can just do whatever they want.
Basically, they have to be seen as pariahs.
Right. If they lose the approval of the public, they'll be forced to change. And those that will not change will fail. Because I think if you really make the connection between the destruction that these companies profit from, and you know, the money that they make, it becomes impossible morally to consider that these companies can continue doing this.
Yeah, I did a show once about the tar sands, and I was looking at the map on Google Maps. It looked like Mordor out of the Lord of the Rings. So, I mean, it's definitely something that we've got to, like, work on.
Oh, yeah.
We have another call. What's this? Greg, what would you like to ask?
Hey, you might want some background on the whole issue in terms of the book is named Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. Just look it up on the web, and it's a free ebook. Written by a doctor, I can't even pronounce his name, but really outlines how to do it by 2050.
Great, carbon-free, nuclear-free. It's possible. We're sort of real, and you do think it's possible.
I do think it's possible.
This guy's got a lot of credibility, so I think it really should be required reading. Not too darn tech, but it's pretty heavy.
Great,
thanks.
You're welcome. Bye.
Thanks a lot.
So that's the second thing I was going to say. We really have to make people understand that it is possible to
fight
back.
Thank you, Greg. Yeah.
To fight back against the fossil fuel industry. It will take an enormous social movement to address those challenges of our climate reality. So divestment is a way to try and combat global warming, but it's also a way to grow a movement, create networks, and change political dynamics. So cooperation is really key for us to change things.
So it's really about getting people. And you had something, David?
Well, yeah, I was just going to add to that. I think that's a really important point in that we cannot address the climate crisis individually.
Right.
We can't, you know, those kinds of changes to our own lifestyle are important. And obviously there's going to be a really significant reduction in consumption. We overconsume in this in our culture to an extreme degree. But this can't be addressed individually. We have to work together. We have to take collective action. So I think it's really important for folks to think about what is appropriate for you. Where can you get involved? Who's your community? How can you engage with others in taking collective action on divestment, and taking collective action to stop a terminal, and taking collective action to do any number of really important things that will be part of the mix and the diversity of actions that will be required to address the climate crisis. And so I think that point around the need for collective action is essential, because we have so many tendencies towards individualism in our society, and that's just not going to do it. We have to work together collectively and take action.
And I think when you think about doing it individually, you know, like I'm recycling, I'm trying to drive less, but then I just see all these cars spinning around, and it's just, you get a sense of just being depressed and how useless it all is. But there's something empowering about being joined with a bunch of people.
Yeah, and I would just also offer that, you know, we live in an unsustainable society, and it's not possible really outside of totally exiting our society entirely to live in anything approaching a sustainable way. And that's not our fault necessarily. This is the society that we, you know,
right,
we just kind of came into. And so we need to be part of movements for systemic change, because we have to change the system that we live
in
so that it is possible for us individually and collectively to live in just and sustainable ways. And that's not something we can consume our way towards. That's not something we can change our individual behavior towards. That's something that we have to be involved with others in to really create completely new social systems, new ways of relating to each other, new economic systems. Like this is a systemic a scope of change that is systemic. We need real significant social change, and that's why being involved collectively in social movements is essential.
And heartening. And it's a huge change that we're being demanded to make now. It's sort of like a live or die. We have another caller. Jimmy, what would you like to ask?
Oh, hey. I just really wanted to echo again some of the things that you guys are saying about the networking and developing the social fabric and the community that we're going to need in order to be able to truly resist the corporations and their immense power. And I just, when you guys were talking, it just keyed something that I was thinking about. Richard Engel, who's a reporter for ABC News, who is an amazing dude, never mind the ABC News part, his story about being in Iraq, a fist in the hornet's nest, I'm reading it now, And in it, he talks about his time in Cairo prior to the fall of Mubarak and how important, how absolutely essential the social fabric that exists in Cairo was to that effort taking place. And, you know, you guys are mentioning this throughout your talk here this morning, and I just really want to echo that back to people. We in this country are really excited and energized by what we saw happen with the Arab Spring and stuff like that, but I think it's really worth stressing to people that
we got to come together.
Yeah, the element that we don't have in our society is that social fabric, and coming out to the action that's going to happen on Saturday, which is, like you guys were mentioning, a very symbolic thing. And
Columbia River action, climate action, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Even coming out to that, even though it may seem to people that are listening that, well, they're not going to accomplish anything there, just coming together and getting to know each other and establishing these bonds with each other is really, from my perspective, the key to our future success. So I just wanted to throw that out there and really maybe just see if you guys had anything more to say to that. And I'm going to hang up now. Thank you all for being there.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thanks. Real quick, I just wanted to also let people know you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. And we're talking about climate actions here in the Northwest. So you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what our caller and Dave were saying. The social movement is just really the core of what we're trying to espouse here. I think that the individualization of our society is one factor, but also the fact that we are identified primarily not as human beings, but as consumers. And
right.
So the way that has translated has worked out really well for fossil fuel companies, because our local legend is, you know, the Lorax tells you to plant a tree, and it's kind of like you individually can make change, and you recycle, and this will make a difference. But really, that's just a way to cover it up and make it seem like you can't do anything. So if you're frustrated out there, and if you're feeling like recycling isn't really doing enough to change something that the government currently isn't really doing much about, I highly suggest getting involved with this, because everything that we do, like the caller mentioned, maybe it doesn't seem like this action is going to make a difference or that action is going to change anything. But as we become heard, they have to listen.
And as this becomes a real issue, the whole climate change issue, which it is finally again becoming an issue, we have another caller, and after that I'd like to get to Bonnie here, because we have a lot going on with the No KXL Pledge of Resistance. But real quick again, how do people find out about the divestment here in
Okay,
Portland?
So if you're interested in getting involved in divestment, go to 350pdx.org. That's our website, and we have a lot of contact information, but also 350.org if you have questions about how divestment works.
Okay, so who's our next caller? John, what would you like to ask?
Hi, you're talking about community connection, and I myself have tried to kind of step up here recently and become more of an active part rather than simply an individual bearing member, altogether too informed about the nature of things going on. Some of the things that I've done that have been helping me are to join organizations like Move to Amend, and the Oregon legislature recently passed the statewide measure urging the U.S. Congress to remove money as speech and corporate personhood.
Good stuff.
And I believe if they get 12 more states, it'll force a constitutional amendment to be addressed on the national level. I did my small part in that, you know, lobbying my state legislatures, the people that represent me. And so it felt really, really good on the individual level when that passed, where I felt like, oh, my goodness, myself in conjunction with others made a small step towards a very necessary and positive change that I think anybody who listens to KBOO would support. So there's organizations like Move to Amend. I also have joined Occupy. I came to Occupy late.
That's
after
good.
After people were no longer actually out in mass. But, like, there's the Occupy Solutions group that it meets this evening at, like, 6:30 in the St. Francis on Southeast 12th. And those folks have been enormously helpful to me. They're activists who have lots of knowledge and are active on many fronts.
That's great, John. I kind of want to get to Bonnie, but it sounds like basically what you're saying is getting involved with a group feels good. It's like that's what I'm hearing.
And also to become informed in ways about not only the issues that concern you, but the actions that you can actually take.
And especially when something actually works. And I wanted to get next to Bonnie here, though, before we, because our show's moving along. But, John, I want to thank you, and I hope people also just find something that works for you and get hooked up with it. It's basically what you're saying.
I do want to say one last thing about that. I really appreciate you calling and saying that, because really I've divestment or, you know, the no Keystone XL pledge are ways to get involved, but there are a lot of ways to get involved to make change. And when people ask me what I think the first step is, I really think Citizens United getting gone is the first one. You know, government not responding to corporate money. So really, any way that you can get involved, there's no wrong way. And in the academic world especially, I've seen this phenomenon of paralysis, like what's the right way to approach,
right?
And just do it your way.
Yeah.
There's no single way.
There's no single way.
There's so many issues.
Exactly.
So many different climate issues.
Exactly. And so but what we're talking about here now with Bonnie is the No KXL Pledge of Resistance, right?
Right.
And what would you like, what exactly is that?
Okay, the No Keystone XL Pledge of Resistance is designed to prevent the Keystone XL pipeline from being completed. The decision on the acceptance The decision on the acceptance or rejection of the pipeline rests with President Obama and us and our entire country. The No Keystone XL Pledge of Resistance campaign has support from people all over the U.S. The project is primarily being organized by the Rainforest Action Network, Credo, and a grassroots organization called the Other 98%. Over this past spring, more than 62,000 people have signed a pledge to risk arrest if necessary to show the president and the country that we are willing to escalate our message of opposition to the pipeline by learning the techniques of nonviolent civil disobedience. We are currently preparing for actions in case these actions become necessary. It's a very transparent organization, a very transparent campaign. We're making every aspect of our training and our implementation of our actions publicly known. We encourage media involvement. This is not at all a secret project.
So it's basically a pledge of resistance where civil disobedience actions are going to be taking place if the Keystone Pipeline gets approved.
Right, and we're currently training people.
Keystone XL Pipeline.
Right, we're currently training people and looking for sites of resistance. And this is happening in communities all over the U.S. So
that's
there's trainings going on everywhere.
And we have another caller. Dan, what would you like to say?
Yeah, hello. I just wanted to say I totally support what you guys are talking about here on the radio, and I just think it's really important, you know, that this actually gets talked about and people actually go and do something. But now what I wanted to say is, don't you think that development of viable alternatives to fossil fuel also plays a pretty important role in this struggle?
What do you say, Bonnie?
Well, certainly, and A big element is conservation as well. There's a lot of energy being wasted and abused. By the end of the summer, the supplementary environmental impact statement on the completion of the Keystone XL pipeline will be issued. Do you want me to continue?
Well, I would like you just then, just tell me directly, why does this matter so much to you? Why don't we just get started here a little bit more?
There's nothing more important, except maybe my family, than combating climate change. I'm a retired elementary teacher. I work on this issue every single day. I hope to see the closing of the entire tar sands project by the time of my death. I plan to work on...
Which is hopefully 40 years away.
All these issues, all fossil fuels, not just Keystone. I'm very concerned about all the terminals in the Pacific Northwest and everywhere on this planet.
Which has to do, again, with getting renewables in there instead of fossil fuels.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm going to be at it till I croak.
And in response also to what Dan, the caller, was saying, he's absolutely right. You know, renewable is really what we need to be focusing our energies on.
Subsidizing.
Also. But that's a big part of divestment also, is when you take your money out of the death merchants, you can put it into so many great things. And renewable energy has really, like, is a growth, like, but there's possibility for profit there, too.
Right. Wind, solar, exactly.
Right. And even one of the first colleges to divest, I was reading an article yesterday, Unity College. It's a small college with a modest endowment, but they have seen growth in their investments since they decided to divest in the past 4 years.
And we have one more caller. John. John, what's up?
Hi. Thanks very much for the program, and thanks, everybody, what you're doing. And I got a couple points. I think politically, Obama would be doing a lot more if he had a majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives. And that's where all spending comes out of, all approval of spending bills of our tax money. And
So getting involved with politics is even something that can be useful.
You bet. And if we have, if you have friends all across the country, please get them to vote and think of these kind of things when they vote. And it's so important that we vote, because that's really, when it comes down to it, oftentimes all we have as working class, what's left of the lower middle class working folk. And another thing, too, I think that would really help us, and I apologize, maybe this has already come up as I tuned in late, is that we maybe have some real simple comparisons of what the U.S. is doing versus, say, other countries. Like, the way I understand it, like, Germany is supposedly way ahead. And
way ahead.
Selling renewable power to other countries.
Solar on practically every roof, I hear. Yes, it's a very different world.
And then the job factor, how many jobs that we create, and instead of subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. And thanks again, and keep fighting.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And back to Bonnie here. So one of the little issues, though, that they talk about, well, there was that train wreck in Quebec, and so people are saying, well, why don't we use pipes instead? And how could you respond to that?
Well, if you're talking about the pipe coming from the tar sands area of Alberta, this fuel is highly corrosive. It's 6 times more corrosive than your normal crude. So the pipelines themselves are a hazard. Pipes break. Right in this period when TransCanada and others are trying to get approval of the Keystone XL, there's been numerous leaks. 2 years ago, the Kalamazoo River had a serious pipe break, and it's still under cleanup. So I don't think pipes are actually the answer.
So it's likely to have disasters with pipes as with trains or anything else. Yeah,
I support John's idea of voting. People did vote, and people will continue to vote, and I totally believe in registering to vote and following that right that most of us have. However, we have to remember what our president did say, and he did say, and I quote, "We cannot afford more of the same timid politics when the future of our planet is at stake. Global warming is not a someday problem, it is now." And we're talking Keystone XL, all the terminals, it's now. And I encourage people to sign up for the pledge if they haven't done so. It's not too late to get trained. And they can go to nokxl.org. They want to call someone locally, they can call 503-705-1943.
Say that again.
I will. That's to become a participant on the No Keystone XL. And that number, I'll do slowly.
Okay.
503-705-1943. 1943.
And so it's a pledge of resistance to actually do civil disobedience. Will there be things that are not?
Absolutely.
And risking arrest?
Right. People can support us in a number of ways. People can be part of the action, providing just on the street, rally support, legal support, media support, and all this comes with training. Mm-hmm. So many people are not in situations where they can get arrested like
right.
I am.
And if you are getting arrested, there will be legal support for you?
There will.
Uh-huh. So it's, and all of this is expected to be taking place if or when Obama approves the
right.
pipeline.
And we'll have the environmental impact statement coming out by the end of August. Then there's a 90-day wait period where the national interest determination is decided if the Keystone XL is indeed in our national interest. Is it or isn't it?
I think you would object to that. And so if he doesn't approve it, nothing happens.
If nothing happens, we celebrate for half an hour and we move on to these many, many other issues.
Other issues, definitely, yeah. Which are crashing down us hugely. Okay, I just want to let listeners know you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter here with the Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. And I've got David Osborne, Tori Cole, and Bonnie McKinley, who are all major activists in the climate movement here in the Pacific Northwest, and they've all got projects going on that you can get involved with. We have another caller. Heidi, what would you like to ask?
Oh, hi there. I just wanted to say I think that 350.org is a wonderful organization, but I called as a longtime social justice activist in the Palestine Solidarity Movement as well as the BDS, the global BDS movement. I'm calling because I want to offer up three key points that 350.org can do better. Mm-hmm. I am involved in a lot of intersectionality work. I've been to two Bill McKibben talks, and I've heard him on numerous radio programs. I've also listened to what you had to say. One of the problems with the 350.org movement is that it's modeling itself after the apartheid divestment campaign, and there has not once been a mention of the fact that there's a global BDS movement going on for Palestine solidarity. There's a lot of language in the 350.org movement that talks about it, and I'm waiting, and I was waiting. You listed, therefore, all these other movements I've been involved in, and not once. And I went to Bill McKibben's talk twice, and he uses all the same language we do. He even put up and mentioned the checkpoints that people had to get through. He mentions the occupation, the checkpoints, yet he doesn't even talk about the fact that there's a huge growing BDS movement, and we have to be intersected with our movements and talk about our movement work in the bigger global picture. So I just wanted to bring, I think if 350.org wants to get better and get more, really thriving social justice advocates, you need to really be making sure that you're giving credit to previous movements. The BDS movement's been around since 2005. Secondly, we need to call out Obama's hypocrisy. He's talking about divestment from coal, except those companies prop him up and help him get elected, as well as the fact that he is funneling billions of dollars into the occupation in Israel, and it is an environmental issue. If anyone at KBOO there or anyone listening understands the way the occupation works, there's environmental degradation happening in Gaza, which is probably one of the worst situations on the planet right now.
Okay.
So it is connected to the movement.
All right. Thank you very much. I just want to know if anybody here wants to respond to any of that. David.
Yeah, I think that your points are all really, really important, and the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement focused on the occupation is a really great example of another contemporary way in which those tactics and strategies are being used. And I would just also offer on the second point as well, and to kind of add on what Bonnie was saying, and that, politicians don't create social change. They just don't. And I think that's important to keep in mind. They can institutionalize social change that is created amongst broad-based popular movements. So what we need to do is not put pressure on politicians. And I think it's really important to keep in mind that the Democrats are just as awash in fossil fuel corporation money as the Republicans, and that the president, President Obama, is a Democrat who may and is really leaning towards potentially approving the Keystone XL pipeline unless folks like Bonnie and all this great Keystone resistance work forces him not to. And so The Democrats alone just being in office wouldn't actually change anything, in my opinion. I mean, in fact, they were in power with a majority in the House and the Senate and the presidency, and they did nothing on climate.
Right.
And so what is, I think, really important is just to know that what our task is not to put pressure on our politicians, but to change the actual ground that they stand in.
Exactly.
So that it is completely unacceptable for them to take any form of action or position other than working for social justice and addressing the climate crisis.
And actually, there was a Keystone Resistance action in 2011 where Obama then was leaning toward approving it, and that halted that, basically, right?
It did delay it. I was there. 1,253 people were arrested at the White House, and I'm sure that's major reason why we're having the no case Keystone XL. Before that, I talked to my well-educated friends, never heard of the tar sands, didn't know about the pipeline. That really brought focus to that. And that focus unites all climate activists on all use of fossil fuel, all fossil fuels.
So. Excellent. And I've read that people are really starting to take climate change seriously. Like it seems like there's been this drop since 2007, and people were believing the stuff, saying that, oh, it's not really a problem, people aren't really doing it, blah blah blah. But it's coming back, and the numbers are something like 54% of Americans think that's over half of us finally think that it's changing because of human activity, and 38% perceive it as a serious threat. That's 91 million people. So how do we get these 91 million people to actually be that ground of resistance, David, that you're talking about? I mean, that sounds like we could take that and then build, and something would start to really happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think we, you know, while on the one hand it's unfortunate that there's not more of a consensus in this country about climate change, on the other hand, we shouldn't get too caught up on that, because it doesn't take huge, overwhelming majorities of people to really begin processes of social change. We can with the kinds of people that already are together on this issue, begin to move really, really strongly and really compellingly. And I think it's partly through taking bold action. It's partly through seeing people take the kinds of action, such as what happened in East Texas, where people were working with rural landowners as part of the Texas tar sands blockade to kind of take that courageous moral action that was stopping the construction of that pipeline for a significant period of time. That galvanized a huge section of the movement. And I think that if we can find those opportunities here in the communities that we live in, what forms of action can we take that clearly speak to the underlying importance and morality of what we are trying to do as part of this movement, that can help bring those other folks that are passively supporters of us but maybe not in a position of taking action to become inspired and to see that what they can do makes a difference. Because I think that's really essential, that so many people, and indeed the power structures that exist, are structured in this way to make people feel like what they do can't do anything.
Yeah.
That's the way power is maintained. If you feel like you have no agency, no ability to do anything, then that is how you can create a system which upholds the extraordinary inequalities that we have today. So if we can take action, and I think this is one of the really the real strengths of direct action, is that it is so clear the power and the ability that we have in those moments, taking those forms of action to change and shape the world in which we live in. We can stop a pipeline being constructed even for a small period of time. We can, as has happened here locally, help homeowners move back into their homes that they were legally foreclosed on by the banks, such as actions that I participated in with many others. Those folks are still living in their houses.
Excellent.
We just move them back in. And when you do things like that, you can really see the extraordinary power that we have as individuals working together in community to kind of create the worlds in which we want to live.
And in a way, it's sort of like we start to take the moral high ground, is what I'm hearing. And like one of the things about divestment, for instance, is that these colleges that are investing, I think it would be $18 million for the University of Oregon to divest from fossil fuels. It's like their reputation starts to be online, right?
Right. And it's actually, you know, it's not just educational institutions, although that's a huge chunk of it. But I mean, think about your church, you know, your local labor union, your, you know, Rotary Club, anything that has money, that money is in large part going to support and fossil fuel companies, because that is the most profitable thing that we have going for our country right now, which is what needs to be fundamentally altered. So, I mean, if you as an organization have any money, then you have power in this movement. It doesn't really matter how much, and the social license, like I said, is the most important thing. And like David said, creating an atmosphere in which doing anything else would be morally objectionable. And I think it's important
and
also
damage the reputation of the institution.
Right. And so like you said, like it's not a majority maybe who would be in this movement, but you don't need everybody. You just need, and we have enough people who are angry about this or who want to see change. Think about the civil rights movement. That wasn't everybody.
91 million people divesting could be huge.
Right. Or just supporting like any of these projects, you know, to stop corporations' money from going into government, to stop the Keystone XL project. Any of these things can really create change, and we need to change into a society in which this is not going to happen anymore.
And if we have more Hurricane Sandys and things like that, we're going to probably get more people on board with us.
Right. I hope that it won't take those that kind of disaster to get people on board, but I mean, it's coming.
Whatever it takes. Yeah. And so once again, let's just talk about that Columbia River Climate Action. It's going to be taking place in Vancouver, and mm-hmm. people can find out about it by doing what, David?
Mm-hmm. People can find out about it by going to portlandrisingtide.org or joinsummerheat.org. Either of those places will have all the details about the directions, how to get there. The most up-to-date stuff is on portlandrisingtide.org, as we're taking a real lead role in organizing this Northwest Action. But yeah, folks have been excited about some of the things that we've been talking about. I mean, this is a real opportunity here coming up this Saturday to take action and to really start to build those kinds of movements that we've been talking about. I mean, we're trying on Saturday to talk not only about coal, which has been talked about mostly in our region, but talk about the coal, oil, and natural gas terminals, because it's all part of this push to turn our region into a dirty fossil fuel corridor, which is not only devastating for our communities, but for all the communities along the rail and pipeline routes, as well as those communities in which the extraction happens, and those globally that will be impacted by the severe effects of climate change. And so folks can come to Vancouver Landing, which is just west of the I-5 bridge. And I should mention, we're in Vancouver because this oil terminal, which was just approved yesterday by the Port of Vancouver for 380,000 barrels a day, is one of the biggest projects in our region, and it's also one that's moving the fastest. And so we are wanting to make sure that folks can see across the region that people in that community and around our region are opposed to that project as well as the other ones, so that there's pressure put on Governor Inslee and others to halt it, but at the same time, not waiting on them to do so. We're also preparing, we're asking people that are interested in learning more about nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience to let us know at that event, so that in the future, if it does come down to us, we can be in a place to stop that terminal from moving forward. So 10:30 workshops, 12:30 speakers, and then 1:30, we're going to have a symbolic blockade. Again, there's not going to be any blocking of ships or traffic or anything like that. It's going to be very fun, family-friendly. You can be on the water or on the land, and we hope to see you out this Saturday.
And you can get a kayak. You can reserve a kayak if you want, if you don't have one yourself.
That's right, yeah. If you email boats, that's boats@portlandrisingtide.org. That information is also on the website. You can try and reserve some of the kayaks that we've gotten available. Those are free. If you're able to donate, that's awesome. But we're trying to make as many boats available to folks that want to get on the water and join us.
And you can so either be on the land, be in the water, be a part of this thing, and have fun.
That's right.
And one last time, give those websites.
So to find all the details about coming and join us this Saturday, the 27th, for the Columbia River Climate Action, you can go to portlandrisingtide.org.
And I also just wanted to say, like, this is sort of Climate Action Week, but the day after this event, there's also going to be that Grow Divestment meetup. If you'd like more information about that, go to growdivestment.org. And that's really an option if you feel like you want to be involved, but you don't know how. We're going to be doing some training, and just come to the event and you'll find out more about that too.
And really quick, I think we're running out of time, but the funeral march tomorrow in Albina, one sentence quick.
Right. Alberta Street, last Thursday parade, funeral march for the Keystone XL, meet at 30th and Alberta at 5:30.
That should be fun. A funeral march for the fossil fuel industry.
The Center for Biological Diversity is putting this on.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, I just want to let listeners know you've been tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and you've been listening to David Osborne, Bonnie McKinley, and Tori Cole, who are all deeply involved in actions that are taking place here in the Pacific Northwest to confront climate change. As I said, I'm Stephanie Potter. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland, and thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 11:59. Coming up next is Jazz Lives with your host, Nick Geffro.
You're listening to KBOO News at Noon for July 24th, 2013. I'm Diane Erickson. The superintendent and the secondary principal at Salem Academy were asked by the Board of Trustees to step down last week. The action was a surprise for parents of the 650 students at the Christian school. The chairwoman of the Board of Trustees emphasized that the action was not the result of misconduct, but part of a new direction the school is taking. Chairwoman Lori Miscut would not detail the new direction or explain why the departing staff were not seen as compatible with the planned change. Some parents indicated they are anxious to get more detail on the change of the direction. Under a federal migrant education program, Hillsborough School District recruited 3 Mexican exchange teachers this summer to teach Mexican culture as a part of the regular curriculum for the migrant summer school at Lincoln Street Elementary. This is part of an initiative to help with the integration of migrant children, which was started in California in 1976. The Departments of Education in Mexico and the U.S. have since partnered to improve the schooling for children who frequently travel between the U.S. and Mexico. The U.S. program focuses on schools with large immigrant student populations, providing funding to enable them to improve schooling for the children of migratory workers. The cost to further train the Mexican exchange teachers is being covered by the Mexican government. Reports indicate a startling increase in the number of bodies being found along the border between Texas and Mexico. It is believed these bodies are those of illegal immigrants seeking to cross into the U.S., who are either killed by their Mexican smugglers or who die from heat stroke. The reported deaths from 2011 are the highest ever, and numbers thus far this year are even higher. However, the number of immigrants seeking to enter the U.S. are actually falling. A bill to limit the power of NSA spying came out of a House committee yesterday. The bill would limit NSA blanket authority under the Patriot Act. The NSA began conducting emergency meetings to have the bill killed by representatives. The White House issued a statement urging the House to reject the bill. Dramatic changes are occurring in the number of young offenders currently being held in the California juvenile prisons. The number of young offenders